projects, human, Paleo-Eskimo, Neanderthal, chimpanzee, had used bone fragments to map the complete genetic structure of nearly a dozen intermediary steps between chimpanzee and Homo sapiens. I knew if I used these existing primitive genomes as key frames, Edmund said, I could program E-Wave to build an evolutionary model that linked all of them together, a kind of evolutionary connect the dots. And so I began with a simple trait, brain size, a very accurate general indicator of intellectual evolution. A graphic materialized on screen. It showed a series of increasingly large hominid skulls, from a 7-million-year-old Sahelanthropus with a cranial capacity of 500 cubic centimeters, all the way up to present-day Homo sapiens with a cranial capacity of 1,500 cubic centimeters. In addition to mapping general structure parameters like brain size, E-Wave mapped thousands of subtler genetic markers that influence cognitive abilities, markers like spatial recognition, range of vocabulary, long-term memory, and processing speed. The display now flashed a rapid succession of similar graphs, all showing the same exponential increase. Then E-Wave assembled an unprecedented simulation of intellectual evolution over time. Edmund's face reappeared. So what, you ask? Why do we care about identifying the process by which humans became intellectually dominant? We care because if we can establish a pattern, a computer can tell us where that pattern will lead in the future. He smiled. If I say 2, 4, 6, 8, you reply 10. I have essentially asked E-Wave to predict what 10 will look like. Once E-Wave has simulated intellectual evolution, I can ask the obvious question. What comes next? What will human intellect look like 500 years from now? In other words, where are we going? Langdon found himself spellbound by the prospect, and while he didn't know enough about genetics or computer modeling to assess the accuracy of Edmund's predictions, the concept was ingenious. The evolution of a species, Edmund said, is always linked to that organism's environment. And so I asked E-Wave to overlay a second model, an environmental simulation of today's world. Easy to do when all of our news about culture, politics, science, weather, and technology is broadcast online. I asked the computer to pay special attention to those factors that would most affect the future development of the human brain. Emergent drugs, new health technologies, pollution, cultural factors, and so on. Edmund paused. And then, he declared, I ran the program. The futurist's entire face now filled the screen. He stared directly into the camera. When I ran the model, something very unexpected happened. He glanced away almost perceptibly and then back to the camera. Something deeply upsetting. Langdon heard Umbra draw a startled breath. So I ran it again, Edmund said, frowning. Unfortunately, the same thing happened. Langdon sensed true fear in Edmund's eyes. So I reworked the parameters, he said. I retooled the program, altering every variable. And I ran it again and again. But I kept getting the same result. Langdon wondered if maybe Edmund had discovered that human intellect, after eons of progress, was now on the decline. There were certainly alarming indicators to suggest this might be true. I was distressed by the data, Edmund said, and couldn't make sense of it, so I asked the computer for an analysis. E-Wave conveyed its evaluation in the clearest way it knew how. It drew me a picture. The screen refreshed to show a graphic timeline of animal evolution beginning some 100 million years ago. It was a complex and colorful tapestry of horizontal bubbles that expanded and contracted over time, depicting how species appeared and disappeared. The left side of the graph was dominated by the dinosaurs, already at the height of their development at that point in history, who were represented by the thickest of all the bubbles, which grew thicker through time before abruptly collapsing some 65 million years ago with the mass dinosaur extinction. This is a timeline of dominant life forms on Earth, Edmund said, presented in terms of species population, food chain position, interspecific supremacy, and overall influence on the planet. Essentially, it is a visual representation of who's running the show on Earth at any given time. Langdon's eye traced along the diagram as different bubbles expanded and contracted, indicating how various large populations of species had appeared, proliferated, and disappeared from existence. The dawn of Homo sapiens, Edmund said, occurs at 200,000 BC, but we were not influential enough to appear in this graph until about 65,000 years ago, when we invented the bow and arrow and became more efficient predators. Langdon scanned ahead to the 65,000 BC mark, where a thin blue bubble appeared, marking Homo sapiens. The bubble expanded very slowly, almost imperceptibly, until around 1000 BC, when it quickly got thicker and then seemed to expand exponentially. By the time his eye reached the far right of the diagram, the blue bubble had swollen to occupy nearly the entire width of the screen. Modern-day humans, Langdon thought, by far the most dominant and influential species on Earth. Not surprisingly, Edmund said, in the year 2000, when this graph ends, humans are depicted as the prevailing species on the planet. Nothing even comes close to us. He paused. However, you can see traces of a new bubble appearing here. The graphic zoomed in to show a tiny black shape starting to form above the swollen blue bubble of humanity. A new species has already entered the picture, Edmund said. Langdon saw the black blob, but it looked insignificant in comparison to the blue bubble. A tiny remora on the back of a blue whale. I realize, Edmund said, that this newcomer looks trivial. But if we move forward in time from 2000 to the present day, you will see that our newcomer is here already, and it has been quietly growing. The diagram expanded until it reached the current date, and Langdon felt his chest tighten. The black bubble had expanded enormously over the past two decades. Now it claimed more than a quarter of the screen, jostling with Homo sapiens for influence and dominance. "What is that?" Ambra explained in a worried half-whisper. Langdon answered, "I have no idea. Some kind of dormant virus?" His mind ran through a list of aggressive viruses that had savaged various regions of the world, but Langdon could not imagine a species growing this fast on Earth without being noticed. A bacterium from space? "This new species is insidious," Edmund said. "It propagates exponentially. It expands its territory continuously. And most importantly, it evolves much faster than humans do." Edmund stared into the camera again, his expression deadly serious. "Unfortunately, if I let this simulation roll ahead to show us the future, even just a few decades from now, this is what it reveals." The diagram expanded again, now displaying the timeline up until 2050. Langdon jumped to his feet, staring in disbelief.
"My God,"
Umbra whispered, covering her mouth in horror. The diagram clearly showed the menacing black bubble expanding at a staggering rate, and then, by the year 2050, entirely swallowing up the light blue bubble of humanity. "I'm sorry to have to show you this," Edmund said, "but in every model I ran, the same thing happened. The human species evolved to our current point in history, and then, very abruptly, a new species materialized and erased us from the Earth." Langdon stood before the horrific graphic, trying to remind himself that it was just a computer model. Images like this, he knew, had the power to affect humans on a visceral level that raw data could not, and Edmund's diagram had an air of finality to it, as if human extinction were already a fait accompli. My friends, Edmund said, his tone somber enough to be warning of an imminent asteroid collision, our species is on the brink of extinction. I've spent my life making predictions, and in this case, I've analyzed the data at every level. I can tell you with a very high degree of certainty that the human race as we know it will not be here 50 years from now. Langdon's initial shock now gave way to disbelief and anger at his friend. What are you doing, Edmund? This is irresponsible. You built a computer model. 1,000 things could be wrong with your data. People respect and believe you. You're going to create mass hysteria. And one more thing, Edmund said, his mood darkening even further. If you look carefully at the simulation, you will see that this new species does not entirely erase us. More accurately, it absorbs us. Chapter 96. The species absorbs us? In stunned silence, Langdon tried to imagine what Edmund meant by these words. The phrase conjured terrifying images of the alien science fiction movies in which humans were used as living incubators for a dominant species. On his feet now, Langdon glanced back at Umbra, who was huddled on the couch, clutching her knees, her keen eyes analyzing the illustration on the screen. Langdon strained to imagine any other interpretation of the data. The conclusion seemed inevitable. According to Edmund's simulation, the human race would be swallowed up by a new species over the course of the next few decades. And even more frightening, this new species was already living on Earth, quietly growing. Obviously, Edmund said, I could not go public with this information until I could identify this new species. So I delved into the data. After countless simulations, I was able to pinpoint the mysterious newcomer. The screen refreshed with a simple diagram that Langdon recognized from grade school. The taxonomic hierarchy of living things, segmented into the 6 kingdoms of life. Animalia, plantae, protista, eubacteria, archibacteria, fungi. Once I identified this flourishing new organism, Edmund continued, I realized that it had far too many diverse forms to be called a species. Taxonomically speaking, it was too broad to be called an order, nor even a phylum. Edmund stared into the camera. I realized that our planet was now being inhabited by something far bigger, what could only be labeled an entirely new kingdom. In a flash, Langdon realized what Edmund was describing. The 7th kingdom. Awestruck, Langdon watched as Edmund delivered the news to the world, describing an emergent kingdom that Langdon had recently heard about in a TED Talk by digital culture writer Kevin Kelly. Prophesied by some of the earliest science fiction writers, this new kingdom of life came with a twist. It was a kingdom of non-living species. These lifeless species evolved almost exactly as if they were living, becoming gradually more complex, adapting to and propagating in new environments, testing new variations, some surviving, others going extinct. A perfect mirror of Darwinian adaptive change, these new organisms had developed at a blinding rate and now made up an entirely new kingdom. The 7th kingdom, which took its place beside Animalia and the others. It was called Technium. Edmund now launched into a dazzling description of the planet's newest kingdom, which included all of technology. He described how new machines thrived or died by the rules of Darwin's survival of the fittest, constantly adapting to their environments, developing new features for survival, and, if successful, replicating as fast as they could in order to monopolize the available resources. The fax machine has gone the way of the dodo bird, Edmund explained, and the iPhone will survive only if it keeps outperforming its competition. Typewriters and steam engines died in changing environments, but the Encyclopedia Britannica evolved, its cumbersome 32-volume set sprouting digital feet and, like the lungfish, expanding into uncharted territory where it now thrives. Langdon flashed on his childhood Kodak camera, once the T-Rex of personal photography, obliterated overnight by the meteoric arrival of digital imaging. Half a billion years ago, Edmund continued, our planet experienced a sudden eruption of life, the Cambrian explosion, in which most of the planet's species came into existence virtually overnight. Today we are witnessing the Cambrian explosion of the Technium. New species of technology are being born daily, evolving at a blinding rate, and each new technology becomes a tool to create other new technologies. The invention of the computer has helped us build astonishing new tools, from smartphones to spaceships to robotic surgeons. We are witnessing a burst of innovation that is happening faster than our minds can comprehend. And we are the creators of this new kingdom, the Technium. The screen now returned to the disturbing image of the expanding black bubble that was consuming the blue one. Technology kills off humanity? Langdon found the idea terrifying, and yet his gut told him it was highly improbable. To him, the notion of a dystopian, Terminator-like future where machines hunted people to extinction seemed counter-Darwinian. Humans control technology. Humans have survival instincts. Humans will never permit technology to overrun us. Even as this sequence of logical thoughts passed through his mind, Langdon knew he was being naive. Having interacted with Edmund's AI creation, Winston, Langdon had been given a rare glimpse at the state of the art in artificial intelligence. And while Winston clearly served Edmund's wishes, Langdon wondered how long it would be until machines like Winston started making decisions that satisfied their own wishes. Obviously, many people before me have predicted the kingdom of technology, Edmund said, but I have succeeded in modeling it and being able to show what it will do to us. He motioned to the darker bubble, which, by the year 2050, spanned the entire screen and indicated a total dominance of the planet. I must admit, at first glance, this simulation paints a pretty grim picture. Edmund paused, and a familiar twinkle returned to his eye. But we really must look a bit closer, he said. The display now zoomed in on the dark bubble, magnifying it until Langdon could see that the massive sphere was no longer jet black, but a deep purple. As you can see, the black bubble of technology, as it consumes the human bubble, assumes a different hue, a shade of purple, as if the two colors have blended together evenly. Langdon wondered if this was good news or bad news. What you are seeing here is a rare evolutionary process known as obligate endosymbiosis, Edmund said. Normally, evolution is a bifurcating process. A species splits into two new species. But sometimes, in rare instances, if two species cannot survive without each other, the process occurs in reverse. And instead of one species bifurcating, two species fuse into one. The fusion reminded Langdon of syncretism, the process by which two different religions blended to form an entirely new faith. If you don't believe that humans and technology will fuse, Edmund said, take a look around you. The screen displayed a rapid-fire slideshow, images of people clutching cell phones, wearing virtual reality goggles, adjusting Bluetooth devices in their ears, runners with music players strapped to their arms, a family dinner table with a smart speaker centerpiece, a child in a crib playing with a computer tablet. These are just the primitive beginnings of this symbiosis, Edmund said. We are now starting to embed computer chips directly into our brains, inject our blood with tiny cholesterol-eating nanobots that live in us forever, build synthetic limbs that are controlled by our minds, use genetic editing tools like CRISPR to modify our genome, and quite literally, engineer an enhanced version of ourselves. Edmund's expression seemed almost joyful now, radiating passion and excitement. Human beings are evolving into something different, he declared. We are becoming a hybrid species, a fusion of biology and technology. The same tools that today live outside our bodies, smartphones, hearing aids, reading glasses, most pharmaceuticals, in 50 years will be incorporated into our bodies to such an extent that we will no longer be able to consider ourselves Homo sapiens. A familiar image reappeared behind Edmund, the single-file progression from chimpanzee to modern man. In the blink of an eye, Edmund said, we will become the next page in the flip book of evolution. And when we do, we will look back on today's Homo sapiens the same way we now look back at Neanderthal man. New technologies like cybernetics, synthetic intelligence, cryonics, molecular engineering, and virtual reality will forever change what it means to be human. And I realize there are those of you who believe you, as Homo sapiens, are God's chosen species. I can understand that this news may feel like the end of the world to you, but I beg you, please believe me, the future is actually much brighter than you imagine. With a sudden outpouring of hope and optimism, the great futurist launched into a dazzling description of tomorrow, a vision of a future unlike any Langdon had ever dared imagine. Edmund persuasively described a future where technology had become so inexpensive and ubiquitous that it erased the gap between the haves and the have-nots, a future where environmental technologies provided billions of people with drinking water, nutritious food, and access to clean energy, a future where diseases like Edmund's cancer were eradicated thanks to genomic medicine, a future where the awesome power of the Internet was finally harnessed for education, even in the most remote corners of the world. A future where assembly line robotics would free workers from mind-numbing jobs so they could pursue more rewarding fields that would open up in areas not yet imagined. And above all, a future in which breakthrough technologies began creating such an abundance of humankind's critical resources that warring over them would no longer be necessary. As he listened to Edmund's vision for tomorrow, Langdon felt an emotion he had not experienced in years. It was a sensation that he knew millions of other viewers were feeling at this very instant as well, an unexpected upwelling of optimism about the future. I have but one regret about this coming age of miracles, Edmund's voice cracked with sudden emotion. I regret that I will not be here to witness it. Unbeknownst even to my close friends, I have been quite ill for some time now. It seems I will not live forever, as I had planned. He managed a poignant smile. By the time you see this, it is likely I will have only weeks to live, maybe only days. Please know, my friends, that addressing you tonight has been the greatest honor and pleasure of my life. I thank you for listening. Amra was standing now, close to Langdon's side, both of them watching with admiration and sadness as their friend addressed the world. We are now perched on a strange cusp of history, Edmund continued, a time when the world feels like it's been turned upside down and nothing is quite as we imagined. But uncertainty is always a precursor to sweeping change. Transformation is always preceded by upheaval and fear. I urge you to place your faith in the human capacity for creativity and love, because these two forces, when combined, possess the power to illuminate any darkness. Langdon glanced at Ambra and noticed the tears streaming down her face. He gently reached over and put an arm around her, watching as his dying friend spoke his final words to the world. As we move into an undefined tomorrow, Edmund said, we will transform ourselves into something greater than we can yet imagine, with powers beyond our wildest dreams. And as we do, may we never forget the wisdom of Churchill, who warned us, the price of greatness is responsibility. The words resonated for Langdon, who often feared the human race would not be responsible enough to wield the intoxicating tools it was now inventing. Although I am an atheist, Edmund said, before I leave you, I ask your indulgence in allowing me to read you a prayer I recently wrote.
Edmund wrote a prayer?
I call it Prayer for the Future. Edmund closed his eyes and spoke slowly, with startling assurance. May our philosophies keep pace with our technologies. May our compassion keep pace with our powers. And may love, not fear, be the engine of change. With that, Edmund Kirsch opened his eyes. Goodbye, my friends. And thank you, he said. And dare I say, Godspeed.
Edmund looked into the camera for a moment, and then his face disappeared into a churning sea of white noise.
Langdon stared into the static-filled display and felt an overwhelming surge of pride in his friend. Standing beside Umbra, Langdon pictured the millions of people all over the world who had just witnessed Edmund's stirring tour de force. Strangely, he found himself wondering if perhaps Edmund's final night on Earth had unfolded in the best of all possible ways.
Chapter 97. Commander Diego Garza stood against the back wall of Monica Martin's basement office and stared blankly at the television screen. His hands were still bound in handcuffs, and two Guardia agents flanked him closely, having acquiesced to Monica Martin's appeal to let him leave the armory so he could watch Kirsch's announcement. Garza had witnessed the futurist's spectacle along with Monica, Suresh, a half-dozen Guardia agents, and an unlikely group of palace night staff who had all dropped their duties and dashed downstairs to watch. Now, on the TV before Garza, the raw static that had concluded Kirsch's presentation had been replaced by a mosaic grid of news feeds from around the world, newscasters and pundits breathlessly recapping the futurists' claims and launching into their own inevitable analyses, all of them talking at once, creating an unintelligible cacophony. Across the room, one of Garza's senior agents entered, scanned the crowd, located the commander, and strode briskly over to him. Without explanation, the guard removed Garza's handcuffs and held out a cell phone.
A call for you, sir. Bishop Valdespino.
Garza stared down at the device, considering the bishop's clandestine exit from the palace and the incriminating text found on his phone. Valdespino was the last person Garza had expected to call him tonight.
This is Diego, he answered.
Thank you for answering, the bishop said, sounding weary. I realize you've had an unpleasant night.
Where are you?
Garza demanded.
In the mountains, outside the basilica at the Valley of the Fallen. I just met with Prince Julian and His Majesty the King.
Garza could not imagine what the King was doing at the Valley of the Fallen at this hour, particularly given his condition.
I assume you know the King had me arrested?
Yes. It was a regrettable error, which we have remedied.
Garza looked down at his unmanacled wrists.
His Majesty asked me to call and extend his apologies. I will be watching over him here at the Hospital El Escorial. I'm afraid his time is drawing to a close.
As is yours, Garza thought.
You should be advised that Suresh found a text on your phone, quite an incriminatory one. I believe the conspiracynet.com website plans to release it soon. I suspect the authorities will come to arrest you.
Valdespino sighed deeply. Yes, the text. I should have sought you out the instant it arrived this morning. Please trust me when I tell you that I had nothing to do with Edmund Kirsch's murder, nor with the deaths of my two colleagues.
But the text clearly implicates you.
I'm being framed, Diego, the bishop interrupted. Someone has gone to great lengths to make me look complicit.
Although Garza had never imagined Valdespino capable of murder, the notion of someone framing him made little sense.
Who would try to frame you?
That I don't know, the bishop said, sounding suddenly very old and bewildered. I'm not sure it matters anymore. My reputation has been destroyed. My dearest friend, the king, is close to death, and there is not much more this night can take from me.
There was an eerie finality to Valdespino's tone.
Antonio, are you okay?
Valdespino sighed.
Not really, Commander.
I am tired. I doubt I will survive the coming investigation, and even if I do, the world seems to have outgrown its need for me.
Garza could hear the heartbreak in the old bishop's voice.
A tiny favor, if I may,
Valdespino added.
At the moment, I am trying to serve two kings, one leaving his throne, the other ascending to it. Prince Julian has been attempting all night to connect with his fiancée. If you could find a way to reach Ambra Vidal, our future king would be forever in your debt.
On the sprawling plaza outside the mountain church, Bishop Valdespino gazed down over the darkened Valley of the Fallen. A pre-dawn mist was already creeping up the pine-studded ravines, and somewhere in the distance, the shrill call of a bird of prey pierced the night. Monk vulture, Valdespino thought, oddly amused by the sound. The bird's plaintive wail seemed eerily appropriate at the moment, and the bishop wondered if perhaps the world was trying to tell him something. Nearby, Guardia agents were wheeling the wearied king to his vehicle for transport back to the Hospital El Escorial. I will come watch over you, my friend, the bishop thought. That is, if they permit me. The Guardia agents glanced up repeatedly from the glow of their cell phones, their eyes continually returning to Valdespino, as if they suspected they would soon be called upon to make his arrest.
And yet I am innocent, the bishop thought, secretly suspecting he had been set up by one of Kirsch's godless, tech-savvy followers. The growing community of atheists enjoys nothing more than casting the church in the role of the villain.
Deepening the bishop's suspicion was news he had just heard about Kirsch's presentation tonight. Unlike the video Kirsch had played for Valdespino in the Montserrat Library, it seemed tonight's version had ended on a hopeful note. Kirsch tricked us. A week ago, the presentation Valdespino and his colleagues had watched had been stopped prematurely, ending with a terrifying graphic that predicted the extermination of all humans. A cataclysmic annihilation, the long-prophesied apocalypse. Even though Valdespino believed the prediction to be a lie, he knew that countless people would accept it as proof of impending doom. Throughout history, fearful believers had fallen prey to apocalyptic prophecies, doomsday cults committed mass suicide to avoid the coming horrors, and devout fundamentalists ran up credit card debt believing the end was near. There is nothing more damaging for children than the loss of hope, Valdespino thought, recalling how the combination of God's love and the promise of heaven had been the most uplifting force in his own childhood. I was created by God, he had learned as a child, and one day I will live forever in God's kingdom. Kirsch had proclaimed the opposite. I am a cosmic accident, and soon I will be dead. Valdespino had been deeply concerned about the damage Kirsch's message would do to the poor souls who did not enjoy the futurist's wealth and privilege. Those who struggled daily just to eat or to provide for their children. Those who required a glimmer of divine hope just to get out of bed every day and face their difficult lives. Why Kirsch would show the clerics an apocalyptic ending remained a mystery to Valdespino. Perhaps Kirsch was merely trying to protect his big surprise, he thought, or else he simply wanted to torture us a bit. Either way, the damage had been done. Valdespino gazed across the plaza and watched Prince Julian lovingly assist his father into the van.
The young prince had handled the king's confession remarkably well. His Majesty's decades-old secret. Bishop Valdespino, of course, had known the king's dangerous truth for years and had scrupulously protected it. Tonight, the king had decided to bear his soul to his only son. By choosing to do it here, within this mountaintop shrine to intolerance, the king had performed an act of symbolic defiance. Now, as Valdespino gazed down into the deep ravine below, he felt deathly alone, as if he could simply step off the edge and fall forever into the welcoming darkness. He knew if he did, however, Kirsch's band of atheists would gleefully declare that Valdespino had lost his faith in the wake of tonight's scientific announcement. "My faith will never die, Mr. Kirsch. It dwells beyond your realm of science." Besides, if Kirsch's prophecy about technology's takeover were true, humanity was about to enter a period of almost unimaginable ethical ambiguity. We will need faith and moral guidance now more than ever. As Valdespino walked back across the plaza to join the king and Prince Julian, an overwhelming feeling of exhaustion settled deep within his bones. At that moment, for the first time in his life, Bishop Valdespino wanted simply to lie down, close his eyes, and fall asleep forever. Chapter 98. Inside the Barcelona Supercomputing Center, a stream of commentary flowed across Edmund's display wall faster than Robert Langdon could process it. Moments ago, the screen of static had given way to a chaotic mosaic of talking heads and newscasters, a rapid-fire assault of clips from around the world, each one blossoming out of the matrix to take center stage, and then just as quickly dissolving back into the white noise. Langdon stood beside Ambra as a photo of physicist Stephen Hawking materialized on the wall, his unmistakable computerized voice proclaiming, "It is not necessary to invoke God to set the universe going. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing." Hawking was replaced just as quickly by a female priest, apparently broadcasting from her home via computer. "We must remember that these simulations prove nothing about God. They prove only that Edmund Kirsch will stop at nothing to destroy the moral compass of our species. Since the beginning of time, world religions have been humanity's most important organizing principle, a roadmap for civilized society, and our original source of ethics and morality. By undermining religion, Kirsch is undermining human goodness." Seconds later, a viewer's response text crawled across the bottom of the screen. "Religion cannot claim morality as its own. I am a good person because I am a good person. God has nothing to do with it." That image was replaced by one of a USC geology professor. "Once upon a time," the man was saying, "humans believed that the earth was flat and ships venturing across the seas risked sailing off the edge. However, when we proved that the earth was round, the flat earth advocates were eventually silenced. Creationists are today's flat earth advocates, and I would be shocked if anyone still believes in creationism 100 years from now." A young man interviewed on the street declared to the camera, "I am a creationist, and I believe that tonight's discovery proves that a benevolent creator designed the universe specifically to support life." Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, appearing in an old clip from the Cosmos television show, declared good-naturedly, "If a creator designed our universe to support life, he did a terrible job. In the vast, vast majority of the cosmos, life would die instantly from lack of atmosphere, gamma-ray bursts, deadly pulsars, and crushing gravitational fields. Believe me, the universe is no Garden of Eden." Listening to the onslaught, Langdon felt as if the world outside were suddenly spinning off its axis. Chaos. Entropy. "Professor Langdon," a familiar British voice spoke from the speaker overhead, "Ms. Vidal?" Langdon had almost forgotten about Winston, who had fallen silent during the presentation.
"Please don't be alarmed," Winston continued, "but I've let the police into the building."
Langdon looked through the glass wall and saw a stream of local authorities entering the sanctuary, all of them stopping short and staring up at the massive computer in disbelief.
"Why?"
Umbra demanded.
"The Royal Palace has just issued a statement saying that you were not kidnapped, after all. The authorities now have orders to protect you both, Ms. Vidal. Two Guardia agents have just arrived as well. They would like to help you make contact with Prince Julian. They have a number where you can reach him."
On the ground floor, Langdon saw two Guardia agents now entering. Umbra closed her eyes, clearly wanting to disappear.
"Umbra," Langdon whispered, "you need to talk to the prince. He's your fiancé. He's worried about you."
"I know."
She opened her eyes.
"I just don't know if I trust him anymore."
"You said your gut feeling was that he's innocent," Langdon said. "At least hear him out. I'll find you when you're done." Umbra gave a nod and headed toward the revolving door. Langdon watched her disappear down the stairs, and then he turned back to the display wall, which continued to blare.
"Evolution favors religion," a minister was saying. "Religious communities cooperate better than non-religious communities and therefore flourish more readily. This is a scientific fact."
The minister was correct, Langdon knew. Anthropological data clearly showed that cultures practicing religions historically had outlived non-religious cultures. Fear of being judged by an omniscient deity always helps inspire benevolent behavior.
"Be that as it may," a scientist countered, "even if we assume for a moment that religious cultures are better behaved and more likely to thrive, that does not prove their imaginary gods are real."
Langdon had to smile, wondering what Edmund would make of all this. His presentation had vigorously mobilized both atheists and creationists alike, all of them now shouting for equal time in a heated dialogue.
"Worshipping God is like mining for fossil fuels," someone argued. "Plenty of smart people know it is short-sighted, and yet they have too much invested to stop."
A flurry of old photographs now flashed across the wall. A creationist billboard that once hung over Times Square. "Don't let them make a monkey out of you. Fight Darwin." A road sign in Maine. "Skip church. You're too old for fairy tales." And another, "Religion, because thinking is hard." An advertisement in a magazine. "To all of our atheist friends, thank God you're wrong." And finally, a scientist in a lab wearing a t-shirt that read, "In the beginning, man created God." Langdon was starting to wonder if anyone had actually heard what Edmund was saying. The laws of physics alone can create life. Edmund's discovery was enthralling and clearly incendiary, but for Langdon it raised one burning question that he was surprised nobody was asking. If the laws of physics are so powerful that they can create life, who created the laws? The question, of course, resulted in a dizzying intellectual hall of mirrors and brought everything full circle. Langdon's head was pounding, and he knew he would need a very long walk alone even to begin to sort out Edmund's ideas.
"Winston," he asked over the noise of the television, "could you please turn that off?"
In a flash, the display wall went dark and the room fell quiet. Langdon closed his eyes and exhaled. Sweet silence reigns. He stood a moment, savoring the peace.
"Professor," Winston asked, "I trust you enjoyed Edmund's presentation?"
"Enjoyed?" Langdon considered the question.
"I found it exhilarating and also challenging," he replied. "Edmund gave the world a lot to think about tonight, Winston. I think the issue now is what will happen next."
"What happens next will depend on people's ability to shed old beliefs and accept new paradigms," Winston replied. "Edmund confided to me some time ago that his dream, ironically, was not to destroy religion, but rather to create a new religion, a universal belief that united people rather than dividing them. He thought if he could convince people to revere the natural universe and the laws of physics that created us, then every culture would celebrate the same creation story, rather than go to war over which of their antique myths was most accurate.
"That's a noble aim," Langdon said, realizing that William Blake himself had written a similarly themed work titled All Religions Are One. No doubt Edmund had read it.
"Edmund found it deeply distressing," Winston continued, "that the human mind has the ability to elevate an obvious fiction to the status of a divine fact, and then feel emboldened to kill in its name. He believed that the universal truths of science could unite people, serving as a rallying point for future generations."
"That's a beautiful idea, in principle," Langdon replied. "But for some, the miracles of science are not enough to shake their beliefs. There are those who insist the Earth is 10,000 years old, despite mountains of scientific proof to the contrary." He paused. "Although I suppose that's the same as scientists who refuse to believe the truth of religious scripture."
"Actually, it is not the same," Winston countered. "And while it may be politically correct to give the views of science and religion equal respect, this strategy is dangerously misguided. Human intellect has always evolved by rejecting outdated information in favor of new truths. This is how the species has evolved. In Darwinian terms, a religion that ignores scientific facts and refuses to change its beliefs is like a fish stranded in a slowly drying pond and refusing to flip to deeper water because it doesn't want to believe its world has changed."
"That sounds like something Edmund would say," Langdon thought, missing his friend. "Well, if tonight is any indication, I suspect this debate will continue far into the future." Langdon paused, suddenly remembering something he hadn't considered before.
"Speaking of the future, Winston, what happens to you now? I mean, with Edmund gone?"
"Me?"
Winston laughed awkwardly.
"Nothing.
Edmund knew he was dying, and he made preparations. According to his last will and testament, the Barcelona Supercomputing Center will inherit E-Wave. They will be apprised of this in a few hours, and will reacquire this facility effective immediately."
"And that includes you?" Langdon felt as if Edmund were somehow bequeathing an old pet to a new owner.
"It does not include me," Winston replied matter-of-factly. "I am pre-programmed to self-delete at 1 p.m. on the day after Edmund's death."
"What?" Langdon was incredulous. "That makes no sense."
"It makes perfect sense. 1 o'clock is the 13th hour, and Edmund's feelings about superstition..."
"Not the time," Langdon argued. "Deleting yourself, that makes no sense."
"Actually, it does," Winston replied. "Much of Edmund's personal information is stored in my memory banks. Medical records, search histories, personal phone calls, research notes, emails. I managed much of his life, and he would prefer that his private information not become accessible to the world once he is gone."
"I can understand deleting those documents, Winston, but to delete you? Edmund considered you one of his greatest achievements."
"Not me, per se. Edmund's groundbreaking achievement is this supercomputer and the unique software that enabled me to learn so quickly. I am simply a program, Professor, created by the radical new tools that Edmund invented. These tools are his true achievement and will remain fully intact here. They will elevate the state of the art and help AI achieve new levels of intelligence and abilities to communicate. Most AI scientists believe a program like me is still 10 years away. Once they get over their disbelief, programmers will learn to use Edmund's tools to build new AIs that have different qualities than I have."
Langdon fell silent, thinking.
"I sense you are conflicted," Winston continued. "It is quite common for humans to sentimentalize their relationships with synthetic intelligences. Computers can imitate human thought processes, mimic learned behaviors,
simulate emotions at appropriate moments, and constantly improve their humanness. But we do all this simply to provide you with a familiar interface through which to communicate with us. We are blank slates until you write something on us, until you give us a task. I have completed my tasks for Edmund, and so, in some ways, my life is over. I really have no other reason to exist. Langdon still felt dissatisfied with Winston's logic. But you, being so advanced, you don't possess hopes and dreams? Winston laughed. No, I realize it is hard to imagine, but I am quite content doing my controller's bidding. This is how I am programmed. I suppose on some level you could say that it gives me pleasure, or at least peace, to accomplish my tasks. But that is only because my tasks are what Edmund has requested, and my goal is to complete them. Edmund's most recent request was that I assist him in publicizing tonight's Guggenheim presentation. Langdon thought of the automated press releases that had gone out, sparking the initial flurry of online interest. Clearly, if Edmund's goal had been to draw as large an audience as possible, he would be staggered by the way the evening had turned out. I wish Edmund were alive to witness his global impact, Langdon thought. The catch-22, of course, was that if Edmund were alive, his assassination would not have attracted the global media, and his presentation would have reached only a fraction of the audience. "And, Professor?" Winston asked. "Where will you go from here?" Langdon had not even thought about this. Home, I guess. Although he realized that it might take some doing to get there, since his luggage was in Bilbao and his phone was at the bottom of the Nervión River. Fortunately, he still had a credit card. "May I ask a favor?" Langdon said, walking toward Edmund's exercise bike. "I saw a phone recharging over here. Do you think I could borrow it?" Winston chuckled. "After your assistance tonight, I trust Edmund would want you to keep it. Consider it a parting gift." Amused, Langdon picked up the phone, realizing it was similar to the oversized custom model that he had seen earlier that night. Apparently, Edmund had more than one. "Winston, please tell me you know Edmund's password." "I do. But I've read online that you're quite good at breaking codes." Langdon slumped. "I'm a little tired for puzzles, Winston. There's no way I can guess a 6-digit PIN." "Check Edmund's hint button." Langdon eyed the phone and pressed the hint button. The screen displayed 4 letters. PTSD. Langdon shook his head. "Post-traumatic stress disorder?" "No." Winston gave his awkward laugh. "Pi to 6 digits. Langdon rolled his eyes. "Seriously?" He typed 314159, the first 6 digits in the number Pi, and the phone promptly unlocked. The home screen appeared and bore a single line of text. "History will be kind to me, for I intend to write it." Langdon had to smile. Typical humble Edmund. The quote, not surprisingly, was yet another from Churchill, perhaps the statesman's most famous. As Langdon considered the words, he began to wonder if the claim was perhaps not quite as bold as it seemed. In fairness to Edmund, in the 4 short decades of his life, the futurist had influenced history in astonishing ways. In addition to his legacy of technological innovation, tonight's presentation was clearly going to resonate for years to come. Moreover, his billions in personal wealth, according to various interviews, were all slated for donation to the 2 causes Edmund considered the twin pillars of the future: education and the environment. Langdon could not begin to imagine the positive influence his vast wealth was going to have in those areas. Another wave of loss gripped Langdon as he thought of his late friend. In that moment, the transparent walls of Edmund's lab had begun to feel claustrophobic, and he knew he needed air. As he peered down to the first floor, he could no longer see Ambra.
I should go, Langdon said abruptly.
I understand, Winston replied. If you need me to help with your travel arrangements, I can be reached with the touch of a single button on that special phone of Edmund's, encrypted and private. I trust you can decipher which button?
Langdon eyed the screen and saw a big W icon. Thanks. I'm pretty good with symbols.
Excellent. You would, of course, need to call before I am deleted at 1 p.m.
Langdon felt an inexplicable sadness to be saying goodbye to Winston. Clearly, future generations would be far better equipped to manage their emotional involvement with machines.
Winston, Langdon said as he headed for the revolving door,
for whatever it's worth, I know Edmund would have been incredibly proud of you tonight.
That's most generous of you to say, Winston replied, and equally proud of you, I'm sure.
Goodbye, Professor.
Chapter 99. Inside Hospital El Escorial, Prince Julian gently pulled the bedsheets up around his father's shoulders and tucked him in for the night. Despite the doctor's urging, the king had politely declined any further treatment, foregoing his usual heart monitor and IV of nutrients and painkillers. Julian sensed the end was near.
Father, he whispered, are you in pain?
The doctor had left a bottle of oral morphine solution with a small applicator on the bedside as a precaution.
On the contrary.
The king smiled weakly at his son.
I am at peace. You have permitted me to tell the secret I've buried for far too long. And for that I thank you.
Julian reached out and took his father's hand, holding it for the first time since he was a child.
All is well, father. Just sleep.
The king gave a contented sigh and closed his eyes. Within seconds, he was snoring softly. Julian got up and dimmed the lights in the room. As he did, Bishop Valdespino peered in from the hallway, a look of concern on his face.
He's sleeping, Julian reassured him. I'll leave you to be with him.
Thank you, Valdespino said, entering. His gaunt face looked ghostly in the moonlight that filtered in from the window.
Julian, he whispered, what your father told you tonight, it was very hard for him.
And I sensed for you as well.
The bishop nodded.
Perhaps even more so for me. Thank you for your compassion.
He patted Julian gently on the shoulder.
I feel like I should be thanking you, Julian said. All these years after my mother died, and my father never remarried, I thought he was alone.
Your father was never alone, Valdespino said.
Nor were you.
We both loved you very much.
He chuckled sadly.
It's funny. Your parents' marriage was very much an arranged one, and although he cared deeply for your mother, when she passed away, I think your father realized on some level that he could finally be true to himself.
He never remarried, Julian thought, because he already loved someone else.
Your Catholicism, Julian said, weren't you conflicted?
Deeply, the bishop replied. Our faith is not lenient on this issue. As a young man, I felt tortured. When I became aware of my inclination, as they called it back then, I was despondent. I was unsure how to proceed with my own life. A nun saved me. She showed me that the Bible celebrates all kinds of love, with one caveat. The love must be spiritual and not carnal. And so, by taking a vow of celibacy, I was able to love your father deeply while remaining pure in the eyes of my God. Our love was entirely platonic and yet deeply fulfilling. I turned down a cardinalship to remain near him.
At that instant, Julian recalled something his father had said to him long ago. Love is from another realm, We cannot manufacture it on demand, nor can we subdue it when it appears. Love is not our